hundreds of billions. But the risk seemed manageable to Rex Tillerson. Everyone involved, everyone, understood that Putin would be in charge, indefinitely, Obiang-like, unchallenged. And Putin would deliver on that promise to remake the federal tax structure of the Russian Federation to accommodate the desires of the oil majors. The mineral extraction tax on the Black Sea properties was to be capped at 10%, and on the Kara Sea at just 5%. Most crucially, Putin offered a guarantee that this tax structure would remain in force for a minimum of 15 years after the project began to produce oil and gas on an industrial scale. Putin stood over Tillerson's right shoulder as the Texan affixed his name to the agreement. When the ink was dry, the two men raised a glass of champagne and toasted the future. This was an historic day for ExxonMobil and Rosneft, Tillerson told Putin. 2 days later, Tillerson and Igor Sechin took part in a video conference to sell the deal to analysts who gathered at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. Sechin was uncharacteristically rhapsodic in his presentation. The announcement of the deal alone, Sechin said, had added $7 billion to the combined value of the two companies. Points for vision. Experts say that this project, in terms of its ambitions, exceeds sending man into outer space or flying to the moon, he crowed. Reuters summed up the news like this: the deal is likely to prove transformational for Exxon. Pause briefly to smile, Rex. Chapter 16. This Ain't No Disco. The oil and natural gas stashes north of the Arctic Circle, according to the U.S. Geological Survey's first ever publicly available assessment of the area in 2008, account for about 22% of the undiscovered, technically recoverable resources in the world. The Arctic accounts for about 13% of the world's undiscovered oil, 30% of the undiscovered natural gas, and 20% of the undiscovered natural gas liquids. A lot of that potential hydrocarbon haul, maybe most of it, resided in Russian territory. But it wasn't going to be easy to get or to deliver to world markets, not without a lot of help. What the Russians brought to the oil and gas game north of the Arctic Circle in 2012 was sheer brute force, which was much needed. Almost any maritime operation in the Arctic promised a punishing battle against the harshest nature can offer. The northern sea route from Murmansk, Russia, up near the northern coast of Finland, through the Barents Sea, the Kara Sea, the East Siberian Sea, the Chukchi Sea, and out through the Bering Strait, it was navigable only a few months a year because of ice. The increasing ice melt caused by climate change was easing the way, but even in the annual midsummer to early autumn thaw, passage required massive, self-propelled sea plows to clear a path in places. Russia had done the hard work to solve this problem back in the last innings of the Soviet era, having started construction on 4 separate nuclear-powered icebreakers. When completed, 2 of the ships had not 1 but 2 nuclear reactors on board. These were ships of hulk and ingenuity, able to cut through layers of ice 8 feet deep at a speed of 10 knots, equipped with a superstructure that included commodious living quarters, recreation areas, and an enormous indoor winter garden for providing fresh vegetables to the crew. Anywhere, anytime. A quarter century later, those 4 Soviet-era seafaring plows were still in operation and formed the backbone of the most able and impressive fleet of icebreakers in the world. No other country had the maritime brawn to match. The U.S. government, by comparison, had constructed only 2 serviceable heavy icebreakers back in the 1970s, and then pretty much stopped. The U.S. Coast Guard's Polar Star, already well past its 30-year life expectancy, was wheezing away on a refurbished but highly suspect electrical system. Its sister ship, Polar Sea, was sitting lifeless at its home berth in Seattle. The Polar Sea had been dead-towed there in 2010 after 5 of its 6 engines failed. The finest repair and modernization experts at Vigor Marine had been unable to bring her back to life. The ship's main continuing utility was in allowing its parts to be cannibalized to maybe keep the dying polar star afloat a bit longer. Americans like to think the dueling superpower thing ended conclusively with the Cold War, with the United States now the undisputed winner in every conceivable matchup between the two countries. But in ice water, turns out Russia still ruled. In 2011, a tanker chartered by Russia, the STI Heritage, made the quickest Northern Sea Route run of that year, just 8 days, with two nuclear-powered, fresh vegetable-producing icebreakers clearing the way. Russian-escorted tankers filled with tens of thousands of tons of iron, jet fuel, and gas condensate had made the Arctic transit more than 30 times that year alone. The Russian Federation was already writing big checks to manufacture four even larger and more powerful icebreakers to lead the fleet, three of them double reactor nuclear, which meant the Russians would be able to plow out to offshore Arctic drilling sites and to deliver crude oil and liquid natural gas from that icy domain to almost any country in the world for years to come. But here was the problem. Despite its unrivaled ice-busting prowess, Russia did not bring much to the actual offshore drilling operations in the frozen north. Russian companies, for instance, offered little in the way of useful drilling rigs or equipment of any kind, not even basics like subsea wellheads. In 2012, having made Russia's economy and its power in the world almost entirely dependent on oil and gas, Putin faced a serious conundrum. His ability to maintain Russia's place as an energy superpower depended almost entirely on availing himself of the expertise and technology of major Western oil companies. Russia had oil companies, sure, but they were gangster economy creations, and not one of them was technically or even financially competent. To do something difficult when it came to oil and gas production, Putin's pet crocodile, Igor Sechin, was going to be of no help. It would have to be ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Shell. They all wanted in, of course. The potential profits were ginormous. But success in the Russian Arctic would require overcoming two very difficult challenges. First, some Western oil major would have to figure out the proper care and feeding of Vladimir Putin, given the desperately high stakes of oil and gas for his presidency. Look at the ashes of Yukos. Look at the chewed-up remains that Putin and Sechin spit out from what used to be BP's joint venture in the country. This was going to be a delicate thing. What Western company would be willing to put itself in service to the Russian government, in service to Putin? Whose shareholders, whose home country would stand for it? Which executives could stomach making that kind of arrangement? And then there was the second difficult prospect for this potential partnership. No one much liked to talk about it, but were the Western oil majors actually capable of drilling up in the Arctic? They said they were, but could they really do it? Good news for President Putin in 2012, he was about to get a true measure of the West's state-of-the-art Arctic offshore drilling operation, such as it was. Royal Dutch Shell, in particular, was an operation worth watching that spring. The company owned more offshore drilling leases in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas off the northern coast of Alaska than anyone, having paid $2.1 billion for the rights to drill there back in 2008. By the beginning of 2010, the company had invested close to $4 billion in its Arctic exploration program and was champing at the bit to start drilling. But as Shell's permits were wending through the final approval process that year, the epically disastrous Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico prompted Obama's Department of the Interior to hit pause on all offshore drilling applications. The president of Shell scrambled to keep hope alive. I want to acknowledge the tragedy of the Gulf of Mexico blowout and oil spill. I commend the Department of Interior for its role in coordinating the unprecedented joint industry-government response effort. The letter was sent to a key Interior Department official less than 3 weeks into the unfolding disaster, while tens of thousands of barrels of oil were still spilling into the Gulf of Mexico each day. The spewing was just getting started, But Shell's president, Marvin E. Odom, wanted it front of mind at Interior that his company was still committed to undertaking a safe and environmentally responsible exploration program in the Chukchi Sea and Beaufort Sea in 2010. Hint, hint, tick-tock. He reminded the deciders at Interior that the waters in Alaska were much shallower than the Gulf of Mexico, that his wells in Alaska would not be drilled nearly as deep as Deepwater Horizon, that Shell would have another rig on site to quickly drill a relief well in the case of a blowout. They'd have plenty of dispersants on hand, too, and most crucially, a prefabricated and pre-staged containment dome in waters nearby. We have already begun to enhance our operational excellence in light of the Deepwater Horizon incident, he said. And we will continuously make adjustments as new learnings are revealed. But the prolonged drama of Deepwater Horizon, nearly 5 months to seal the well for good, and only after almost 5 million barrels of oil flooded into the Gulf of Mexico, it was just too much to overcome. Shell had to cool its operationally excellent jets while the 2010 and then the 2011 drilling seasons passed. Since it couldn't drill during that time, Shell focused its operational excellence instead on its paperwork, which, it must be said, was demonstrably enhanced during that time out. The drilling application Shell filed for the 2012 season was its finest ever. The oil spill response plan alone ran more than 400 pages and incorporated the latest in best practices, thanks to all those Deepwater Horizon learnings. Relief wells and government-approved dispersants were all the rage. Shell had them. Containment dome was a must. Shell had it. And the Obama administration seemed to be buying what Shell was selling. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar noted in public statements that the seas in the Arctic drilling region were, in fact, much shallower than in the Gulf of Mexico, and that he trusted Shell professionals when they said they could trap and contain all but about 10% of any spill. Salazar said in 2012, "I believe there will not be an oil spill. If there is, I think the response capability is there to arrest the problem very quickly and minimize damage." Shell's capabilities, the Department of Interior insisted, had been borne out by drills, inspections, and tabletop exercises. It was left unsaid whether these tabletop exercises involved scale models of the industry's only proven oil spill cleanup tool, which was still basically just paper towels. Stands to reason that there would be some magical thinking going on in 2012. There was a president who needed reelecting, which, as every armchair political scientist knows, would be made more difficult if American commuters and vacationers were screaming mad about the highest gasoline prices in history. Obama had hit the GOP on high gas prices, and to great effect, in the 2008 campaign season. But the high price of gas in 2012 was on Obama's watch. And in 2012, it was worse even than the previous summer's record highs. The Obama administration was careful not to invoke drill, baby, drill, but it was not going to be seen standing in the way of any new energy sources, not in an election year. Wind, solar, the spoils of fracking, Arctic oil and gas, it was all on the tabletop. Alaska's energy resources, onshore and offshore, conventional and renewable, hold great promise and economic opportunity for the people of Alaska and across the nation. So said Ken Salazar, Obama's Secretary of the Interior. Still, the Obamanauts were cautious and kept invoking their insistence that good science should rule decisions. Official permission for Shell to drill in federal waters in the Alaskan Arctic rolled out slowly in the first months of 2012 and was in no way final. There were a lot of contingencies to the approval, like making sure all the components of Shell's promised oil spill response program were available on site. Shell bosses appeared confident they could pull it off. Hell, with crude oil prices back up over $100 a barrel, the company was actually increasing its ambitions in the Arctic. Shell filed updated plans to drill 4 wells in the Beaufort Sea off Alaska's remote north shore and another 6 in the little explored Chukchi Sea just west of Beaufort. But time was of the essence. Even factoring in increasing ice melt caused by climate change, there was still a very narrow window of reasonable weather north of the Arctic Circle. Encroaching ice would close off safe operations around November 1st. The Department of Interior narrowed Shell's window for drilling even further. The company would need to finish up drilling about 5 weeks before that date, Interior insisted, so that any oil spill response could be performed in open water before the seas froze over. The Coast Guard's moribund Polar Sea was not going to be coming to anybody's rescue. That meant Shell had to cease drilling into known hydrocarbon zones by September 24th. The company could noodle around out there until about Halloween, but not anywhere it might hit oil or gas. So this was a race, and it loomed as an epic test of man against nature. Shell pronounced itself ready for the task. When the first of Shell's 21-vessel flotilla pulled out of Puget Sound and headed north for Alaska in the last week of June 2012, Seattle's seagoing community looked on with excitement and pride. "I think there will be huge opportunities for seafarers out here," said Carl Ellis, assistant dean of the Seattle Maritime Academy. "The industry in the Gulf is finally coming back, and we're going to see the same thing in a microcosm in the Arctic." The prized ornaments of the fleet were two fresh-painted blue-and-white drill ships, both of which had been refurbished by the pros at Vigor. Shell could certainly have afforded to build brand-new state-of-the-art drill ships for this mighty endeavor, but it chose to go the more, shall we say, economical route. Why spend extra money to protect a $4 billion investment in a region that might produce oil and gas for 40 or 50 years? Nah, let's go with used. But let's really trick them out. Vigor had spent nearly a year upgrading Shell's cone-shaped 266-foot by 230-foot Kullach. The company had retrofitted all the Kullach's waste systems, for instance, to ensure that there would be exactly zero discharge of liquids from the rig into the pristine Arctic seas. No oil, no diesel fuel, no sewage, no sink water, no nothing. "Everything down to the smallest detail is centered on protecting the environment," said Vigor's senior director of ship repair as the fleet motored away. "Ensuring safety at all levels was our primary focus." The Vigor company website boasted, "Even the blue and white paint scheme was chosen to accommodate the preferences of whales." This was news on a few fronts, not the least that whales have color preferences. The Kullach was also newly equipped with what Marine Log magazine called a bird avoidance system, though it is hard to imagine how exactly this gargantuan, buoy-like rig, a propellerless 28,000-ton mobile offshore drilling unit, could make a controlled feint around an eagle or two. Still, it did sound good. Bang up paperwork. The second drillship in the Alaska-bound flotilla was the Discoverer, which Shell had contracted from the Noble Corporation. Unlike the Kullach, which had to be towed north by an ice-class tugboat, the Discoverer cruised out to sea on its own power. The Discoverer was a kind of maritime version of the little engine that could. Known affectionately by its 124-person crew as the Disco, the vessel was an underdog with an unprepossessing backstory, and by nautical standards, a pretty long one. The Disco was the second oldest drillship at sea. The vessel was built in Japan in 1966 and launched as the Matsushiro Maru. It began life as a bulk carrier with the unromantic duty of hauling wood from North America to Asia. Converted into a drillship in New Orleans way back in 1976, by 2010, the Disco seemed to be limping toward the salvage yard. And, spoiler alert, it would be there soon. It did sport a handsome, newly installed main drill rig at midships that year, but everything else on board was dicey. A second mate who served briefly on the Disco in 2010 was horrified at its condition. "Parts of it below decks looked like Swiss cheese," she wrote. "Not good." The main engine wouldn't start, and it was so old the ship's mechanics were hard-pressed to find replacement parts. If you turned on the fire pump, it spit water into a giant maw that formed a swimming pool that rose from the bilge to the main deck. Nobody seemed to know exactly why, or to be much concerned about it, according to the second mate. She ended up resigning her post after just 3 weeks on board. But Shell had faith in the Disco. In 2011, in anticipation of its upcoming Arctic adventure, Shell dispatched the creaky 45-year-old ship on a shakedown operation in the relatively calm waters off the coast of New Zealand. It shook down all right. It just didn't shake down too good. A quick series of modest New Zealand storms that April knocked the Disco cockeyed. Its anchor lines snapped, some of its drilling equipment dislodged and sank to the ocean floor. The veteran drillship was so badly damaged, wrote a reporter from the Taranaki Daily News as he looked at the idle vessel all lit up in the waters just beyond the port, that it will be unable to return to drilling operations anytime soon. Noble and Shell kept the faith, though, and were determined to make the Disco seaworthy once again, even Arctic seaworthy. They hired Vigor Marine to make it so. But then came the freaking superheroes. On the day before the Disco was due to head from Taranaki to Vigor's shipyard in Seattle in February 2012, 8 environmental activists, including Lucy Lawless, the actress who played Xena, Warrior Princess, they managed to sneak aboard and scale the 175-foot-high drilling tower, festooning it with banners reading, "Stop Shell and Save the Arctic." The activists refused to come down off the Disco's tower. They had brought food enough for a week. Environmentalists, as a rule, try to eat light. Taranaki police boarded the ship to effect arrests, but the protesters told the local gendarme they were not going anywhere. Xena and her fellow eco-warriors said they had a moral obligation to keep the Disco from its next appointment. Lucy Lawless told the gathered press, "Deep-sea oil drilling is bad enough, but venturing into the Arctic, one of the most magical places on the planet, is going too far. I don't want my kids to grow up in a world without these extraordinary places intact." The protesters did eventually disembark, but the to-do made the Disco almost a week late in getting to its rejuvenation berth at Vigor Marine in Seattle, at a time when every day counted. Vigor had already assembled a team of more than 500 to hasten the upgrades necessary to make the Disco ready for drilling the Alaskan Arctic. The crew scrambled to complete its work, which would generally take 6 months. They got it done in just 10 weeks. The ship was newly winterized, its hull reinforced to do battle with Arctic ice. The long in the tooth vessel now had 6 engines that not only started, but were equipped with 20-foot-high catalytic converter equivalents that made the Disco's carbon emissions somewhere between negligible and non-existent. And all the work was completed on time. It is impossible to overstate the pride Vigor Marine teams have felt working on these critical rigs, a company spokesman reiterated as the flotilla disappeared over the horizon and churned north toward its great Arctic challenge. The noble discoverer, the Disco, was clearly feeling its oats on the trip to Alaska. It left the Kulik and its tugboat in its wake. On July 7th, the Disco pulled into Dutch Harbor, a little port town near the midpoint of the Aleutian Islands, which jut like a tail into the Bering Sea. Other vessels in its little fleet were still churning slowly up the North American coast, probably a week away from the Alaskan port. Shell decided to wait up for the rest of the team. It would anchor the Disco at Dutch Harbor until it was time to make the 1,000-mile trip further north, through the Bering Strait, to the drilling grounds in the Chukchi Sea. But it didn't take long for things to go wobbly. One late afternoon, a few days into the Disco's stay at Dutch Harbor, the Arctic winds kicked up to 35 miles per hour and got the better of the ship. We received a report at about 5:18 p.m. that the anchor let go and they were traveling toward shore, a rather laconic Coast Guard spokeswoman later explained. The Disco reeled aimlessly and out of control for nearly half a mile that night before it ran aground on a remote little spit of land called Hog Island. When first light came up the next morning, it looked bad. But Shell got out ahead of the news and insisted the vessel had not actually grounded, but stopped very near the coast, maybe 175 yards from shore. By the next afternoon, the company had towed the drillship back to its original mooring position, and a dive team inspection confirmed that no damage was done to the hull or any other part of the ship. However, Disco Pride did not escape the incident unwounded. Locals and environmentalists, they seemed to be everywhere the Disco went, had already posted online a series of morning-after photos of the worse-for-wear drillship resting slightly atilt in the soft sand bed at what actually looked to be only about 20 feet from shore. A week later, still in Dutch Harbor, the Disco began vomiting oily bilge water from its holding tank into the bay, coating the waters nearby with an unsightly sheen. The Disco's storage tanks were proving unequal to the amount of effluent produced by the ship, even after the crew made secret modifications to what one regulator genteelly called its decanting system. A federal inquiry would later explain it. Noble devised a makeshift barrel and pump system to discharge water that had entered the vessel's engine room machinery spaces directly overboard without processing it through the required pollution prevention equipment as required by law. Noble failed to notify the Coast Guard about this system and took steps to actively hide the fact that it was being used. But this federal finding would come only much later, long after Shell tied up its operations for the season. Back in July, it seemed like maybe the Disco was just getting used to the choppy Alaska seas. Maybe it was just a little green around the gills. 3 weeks after the unfortunate "We Swear We Didn't Run Aground" incident, the Disco and the Kulluk and most of the rest of the Shell fleet were all still lying low in Dutch Harbor, more than 1,000 miles away from the drill sites in the Beaufort and Chukchi seas. A small commercial icebreaker and a couple of other ships were at the two sites making early preparations, but it was becoming evident that Shell's paperwork excellence had outrun its operational excellence by a long shot. Even at that late date, the linchpin of Shell's 400-plus-page oil spill response plan, a ship called the Arctic Challenger, tasked with hauling the dispersants and the big paper towels and the crucial and promised containment dome to Shell's Arctic drilling sites, it was back in Bellingham, Washington, just north of Seattle, still on the maritime operating table. Superior Energy Services was having a hell of a time converting that ship into a certifiable ice-class oil spill response vessel. Like the Disco, the Arctic Challenger, a vintage 1976 barge, had grown a bit flabby over its long life, and understandably so. It had been inactive for the previous 10 years. Superior Energy Services was working overtime to upgrade the ship's electrical system, its fire safety system, and its entire piping system, among other things, to gain the required Coast Guard certification. After conferring with the Coast Guard, local reporters suggested that those prospects didn't look great. As of August 4th, about 400 items still needed to be completed, inspected, or reviewed. Even as the Disco and the Kulluk and the tugs and the icebreakers loitered in Alaska, watching the days tick by on the calendar, neither the Arctic Challenger nor the containment dome it was to carry was ready to take the in-water tests required before the Coast Guard could certify the ship for Arctic duty. As McClatchy reported on August 14, 2012, the opportunity to drill exploratory wells this year in Alaska's Arctic is rapidly diminishing, and it's a situation of Shell's own making, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar told reporters. Salazar, who was on a personal visit to the drill sites in the far north of Alaska, sounded a little peeved. The waters in the Chukchi around the so-called Berger find are in fact already open, he said. So it's not a matter of ice. It's a matter of whether or not Shell has the mechanical capability to be able to comply with the exploration effort that had been approved by the government. When the Challenger did finally get out into open waters in Puget Sound a month later to show inspectors from the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement what it could do, things went from bad to worse. During the inspection, BSEE staff observed the absence of clear lines of authority on the vessel and the operation was beset by problems such as the tangling of a remotely operated vehicle in the dome's rigging, a loose connection on one of the winches, and a serious miscalculation of the amount of weight attached to the dome to keep it submerged, read a later Interior Department review. The containment dome, which had been positioned at a depth of more than 100 feet, rose rapidly through the water and breached the surface. A few minutes later, the tanks providing buoyancy to the dome vented, and the dome quickly plunged. It sank too rapidly to allow for pressure equalization, and the upper chambers of the dome were crushed. So, the Arctic Challenger would not be leaving Puget Sound that season. Its vaunted oil containment dome was now basically a stomped-on soda can. Turns out Shell had a terrific oil spill response plan, really excellent paperwork, but no way to affect it. By the time Shell's drill ships finally completed the trip from Dutch Harbor to their final Arctic destination, their mission had been greatly circumscribed. The company had received official permission to complete top holes only. That meant Shell could drill down about 1,400 feet into the seafloor to a depth where its engineers were in no danger of actually hitting oil or gas, just to install a few preliminary well necessities, then cap the hole and leave it in place for the next season. The Shell executives and the crew on the Disco showed a brave face to the world in spite of the setback. Shell posted a video of a Disco drill bit ready to spin down into the Arctic seabed. And this was no ordinary spin of the drill. "This marks the culmination of more than 6 years of effort by Shell," shouted the website on September 9, 2012. "This is the first time a drill bit has touched the seafloor in the U.S. Chukchi Sea in more than two decades." Managers on site in the Arctic, meanwhile, were starting to shout something else, something more like, "Get the heck out of there." An ice floe, 30 miles long and 10 miles wide, with a keen Arctic gale at its back, was already bearing down on the Disco. 12 hours after that historic touch of the drill bit, the Disco had to disconnect, draw up its heavy anchors, and boogie. The ice floe did pass by, and the Disco crew was able to get back to work to finish up its top hole. The mission even generated a little press, and not all of it bad. A Wall Street Journal reporter, Tom Fowler, choppered out to the Disco several weeks after operations recommenced. He spent a few days observing the goings-on and reported back to the mainland. The rig's 124-person crew included a half-dozen wildlife spotters hired from native Alaskan firms, he wrote near the end of October. While federal environmental laws don't require such spotters, Shell brought them on board to ease concerns among the Inupiat people, who worried about impacts on their annual whale harvest. Jennifer Scott, one of the biologists on watch, said there were some signs of life amid the empty expanse. In addition to humpback and bowhead whales, a polar bear swam by the vessel one day, and a snowy owl took up temporary residence above the bridge. The drilling crews on deck didn't have time to notice. They moved steel casing and pipes into place as the ice-slicked decks heaved with the waves, trying to make the most of the lowered drilling expectations. In a few weeks, the area will be encased in sea ice again, blocking Shell's progress for another year. At the end of the short drilling season that included dodging ice floes and native Alaskans who would not allow their semi-annual whale hunt to be impeded, Shell had little to show for its now $5 billion investment. One Disco-drilled top hole in the Chukchi, one Kulik-drilled top hole in the Beaufort, a smattering of press. And in the coming months, there would be more of only one of those three things. The Disco was the first drill ship to pull up anchor and head down to Dutch Harbor, the way station in its 3,000-mile trip back to the Vigor shops in Seattle, for a tune-up and resupply in anticipation of the 2013 season. But as the Disco neared Dutch Harbor on November 6th, vibrations in its propeller shaft became so violent the ship's main engine had to be shut down. The Disco was towed, sheepishly, back into Dutch Harbor again. 10 days later, and still in the harbor, when the crew attempted to start the main engine, it detonated a backfire explosion powerful enough to be felt, not just heard, but felt, by people hundreds of yards away. The attempt also ignited the insulation in the engine room, leaving the crew racing to extinguish the flames. The Disco had to be dead-towed to a port in Seward, Alaska, for a full-on Coast Guard inspection, an inspection that brought to light all of the Disco's dirty little secrets. Here were a few of the notable Coast Guard findings, beyond the drillship's ongoing and unseemly oil-laden bilgewater puke fests. Objective evidence revealed systematic failure and lack of main engine preventive maintenance, which caused loss of main propulsion and exhaust system explosion. Multiple fire screen doors throughout accommodation spaces that would not self-close. Main engine piston cooling water is contaminated with sludge and oil. Crew skims the oil off with a ladle and bucket during rounds. Yeah, what state-of-the-art multi-billion dollar project doesn't include a little ladle and bucket duty? Back to the Coast Guard findings. Exhaust system backfires on a regular basis. Chief engineer suspects this is due to change to exhaust system in order to accommodate helicopter deck installation. Current propulsion arrangement does not result in sufficient speed at sea to safely maneuver in all expected conditions. Observed oil-soaked structural fire protection insulation in way of exhaust. No evidence of at least one monthly emergency evacuation plan drill between September 23rd and October 26th. Observed multiple dead-end wires and improper wire splices throughout main engine room. The Coast Guard took the unusual step of placing the Disco under port state detention, the maritime equivalent of double secret probation, which raised the Disco immediately into the top 1% of safety violators. Coast Guard officials were also inspired to take the even more rare action of making a criminal referral to the Department of Justice, which resulted in Noble Corporation eventually copping a plea to 8 separate environmental and maritime felonies. Noble forked over $12.2 million in criminal fines and community service payments. And this was in addition to the $710,000 in civil fines that Shell paid for the Disco's 23 separate violations of its Clean Air Act permits. Apparently, the Disco's actual noxious emissions were considerably north of negligible or non-existent. Shell chalked up its excessive hourly nitrous oxide emissions to what its president had called new learnings revealed. Following a season of operations, a Shell spokesperson said as the company made out the check for its civil fine, we now better understand how emissions control equipment actually functions in Arctic conditions. Shell's opportunities for new learnings about functioning in Arctic conditions had not been entirely extinguished at the end of that November, thanks to the Kulik and its dedicated tugboat, the Eivik. The Eivik had by then hauled the Kulik through the slushy-like Beaufort Sea and back into manageable water near Dutch Harbor. Shell had the option of shoveling the snowdrifts from the Kulik's deck and leaving the drillship parked safely at Dutch Harbor. Its anchor system was far superior to the Disco's, and it had a customized rounded berth in Dutch Harbor. They had the option to keep it there until the new season opened up the next summer. But the company was anxious to get the Kulik back to Seattle for a couple of reasons. First, the Arctic battering had left the Kulik in need of the expert ministrations of Vigor Marine. But second, Shell executives were hoping to outrun an oil facilities tax levy from the state of Alaska. Shell was under the impression that if the Kulik remained in the state of Alaska past January 1st, the company would owe about $6 million to Alaska in taxes. A Shell spokesman wrote in an email to a local reporter in Dutch Harbor, "It's fair to say the current tax structure related to vessels of this type influenced the timing of our departure." And so the decision was made in early December to execute the 2,000-mile trip back to Washington State before the Kulik would turn around and come back up to try Alaska again next season. That trip would become one of the most documented sea voyages of the 21st century. The Department of the Interior, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the National Transportation Safety Board all investigated and weighed in with reports. The combined page count of the government reports and their investigation notebooks neared, if not exceeded, that of Moby Dick. Mackenzie Funk wrote a riveting 9,200-word piece for the New York Times Magazine that detailed, among lots of other things, the weight of the 18 crew members chosen to ride the Kulik back to Seattle. The smallest was about 235 pounds. Many of them tipped the scales at over 300. Observant marine and offshore drilling professionals called the voyage a shambolic misadventure and a clown circus. Yes, many, many new learnings were revealed. There were things that should have given Shell pause about embarking on the towing operation in the first place. Shell's preferred marine warranty survey company wouldn't sign off on the tow plan. Too risky in an Arctic winter. So in order to keep its insurance in force, Shell had to scramble to get a different company to sign off, which the new company did after a hasty and incomplete inspection of the Ivic, the Kulik, and the always excellent paperwork. The surveyor assigned to the inspection did not conduct an independent assessment concerning the overall adequacy of the towing equipment, the Coast Guard report noted. He stated that conducting this type of analysis was not in his scope of work as a warranty surveyor. Add to this that Shell did not send its tow plan to a single federal or state agency for review. Add to this that Shell's experienced operations manager chose that moment to go on holiday. His designated replacement, who gave final approval to the tow plan, was a new employee who, according to the Coast Guard, had never reviewed a tow plan within Shell and had not participated in any of the planning meetings, had not received training in the tow planning or review process, and had not received any specific instructions, debrief, or guidance from his supervisor on this process. Other than that, of course, he was the perfect man for the job. Consider a few other things that were ill-considered by the various decision-makers here. The conical design of the Kulik complicated any towing operation. This 266-foot-high, 28,000-ton unit was likely to rock and spin in heavy seas, causing huge swings in the amount of tension on the tow chains. It was like towing a large saucer for a teacup, said a tugboat master who had actually tugged the Kulik. Like a buoy the size of a football field, said one Coast Guardsman. Then, too, there was the fact that the Ivic would have to execute the entire 2,000-mile tow by its lonesome, without a backup tug on hand. In its defense, the Ivic was one of the most powerful ice-class tugboats on the water, and its crew had great confidence. "Do you have any major engineering issues?" the Marine Warranty Surveyor asked its chief engineer in their one brief meeting on the day the towing operation embarked. "No," the Ivic's chief engineer answered. "Okay, good enough." But the truth was, the Ivic was a little worse for wear on that day of departure, December 21st, 2012. The tug's fuel injectors had been on the fritz for nearly 4 months, which caused occasional losses of propulsion. One of its thrusters was unusable. A fuel tank cracked. One of its generators occasionally failed, which diminished the tug's electrical output. The Ivic had first suffered serious damage when it took on water while towing the Kulik north in heavy seas at the end of August. 10 weeks after that, on the return trip from the Beaufort Sea back to Dutch Harbor, one of the Ivic's engines failed mid-tow, and the electrical system had gone completely dark. None of the Ivic's mechanical deficiencies was reported to the Coast Guard, even though notification was expressly required under the Code of Federal Regulations. Still, the officers on the bridge of the Ivic remained confident, and confidence-inspiring as they pulled the Kulik out to sea on December 21st. The seamen had proper licensing and training, and as far as the Coast Guard was concerned, could have towed anything anywhere in the world. But this was their first duty in Arctic waters in winter, and there was something of a learning curve. They had been warned to expect gales approaching 50 knots and dangerous 35-foot-high swells. The annual guidebook published by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was blunt in its warnings. The Aleutian Low looms over the North Pacific as a climatic warning to mariners navigating the Alaskan waters. This semi-permanent feature is made up of the day-to-day storms that traverse these seas in a seemingly endless procession, With these storms come the rain, sleet, snow, the howling winds, and the mountainous seas that make the northern Gulf of Alaska and the southern Bering Sea among the most treacherous winter waters in the northern hemisphere. The second day into the three-week trip, the seas were already rocking, and the weather reports for the next 3 days promised much worse than the planners had anticipated. The captain of the Ivik probably wished he had been more adamant in his demands to raise the fuel vents on the soon-to-be waterslogged deck of his tug. He had certainly already begun to appreciate the drift of his near future. He wrote in an email to his cohort on the Kullock that day, "To be blunt, I believe that this length of tow, at this time of year, in this location, with our current routing, guarantees an ass-kicking." The full-on ass-kicking, in fact, commenced about 72 hours later, not long after the Kullock's 18-man crew finished its Christmas Day barbecue. By midnight, there were gale-force winds and swells the size of houses, Mackenzie Funk wrote in his New York Times Magazine epic. Rather than crash forward through the building swells, as other ships might, the Kullock marked their passage like a giant metronome, pitching and rolling, a stomach-churning 5, then 7, then 10 degrees off vertical. 600 yards ahead, the same waves were bucking the Ivik, but the two ships were out of sync. The tow line between them was slack one moment, then crackling with tension, then slack again. The winds continued to blow somewhere between 25 and 50 knots for the next day and a half. Swells 15 to 18 feet high crashed continuously over the decks of both ships. The big buoy-like Kullock continued its maritime version of the twist. The tow line between the two vessels sagged and then shot tight. The captain of the Ivik tried to alter course, but nothing much helped. From 5:30 to 11:30 on the morning of December 27th, when the swells rose to over 20 feet, the wire tensile strength overload alarm sounded 38 times. The bridge crew, exhausted from 12-hour watches and from fighting the constant storms, did little to address the problem. Though experienced in towing operations, read the Coast Guard's later report, they possessed less experience in Gulf of Alaska waters, particularly during the wintertime. This specific lack of experience was displayed during the towing operations on December 27th, where the crew took ineffective action to reduce extremes in tow line tension during a period of nearly 6 hours. At 11:35 that morning, the overtaxed tow line between the Ivik and the Kullock snapped, and one 120-ton shackle dropped away to the ocean floor. The crews pulled off the heroic feat of attaching a new emergency tow line in just 3 hours. But the Ivik emerged from that operation badly damaged. The tug had executed a dangerous U-turn to get back to the Kullock and taken on huge amounts of the sea in one spectacular roll. A giant steel hook fell from its housing and had to be welded to the deck for safety. As Mackenzie Funk described it, enormous anchor balls broke loose and careered around the deck. Even more dangerous, seawater sloshed into those unraised fuel vents. A few minutes before midnight, one of the Ivik's seawater-logged engines went down. By 3 o'clock the next morning, all four engines were drowned, lifeless. Coast Guard helicopters flew in replacement parts, and the Ivik crew was able to retool and restart its engines. Over the next 3 days, various Coast Guard boats and a private tug called the Alert were called in to take turns towing the Kullock alone or in tandem with the hastily revived Ivik. When the weather and the weight of the Kullock weren't pulling these boats backwards or toward shore, the tugs were able to hold steady or plow ahead at about one knot, which is the speed of a baby crawling. Or more precisely, perhaps, the speed of a baby learning to crawl. At Shell's request, a Coast Guard team executed a dangerous helicopter rescue of the men left stranded on the rocking Kullock. Because of weight limits, it took 3 separate trips to get those 18 trenchermen to safe ground. The upside? The men survived to work another season. The downside? The evacuation of all personnel also left the Kullock incapable of dropping anchor. As New Year's Eve approached, every boat but the Alert was out of commission, and the weather was taking another ugly turn. The winds gusted up to 60 knots that afternoon, and the swells rose to 35 feet, propelling the Kullick toward shore. The captain of the Alert ordered its two engines cranked up to 100% capacity, using all of their 10,192 horses, just to keep the Kullick stationary. And then the tug's onboard alarm began to wail. The exhaust manifold was overheating. The two engines were in danger of burning out. The captain of the Alert throttled down to 85% power and watched as the great, whale-pleasing, blue-and-white hulk he was towing drifted toward shore. Finally, at 8 p.m. on New Year's Eve, Coast Guard officials ordered the Alert to release its hold on the Kullick and save itself. The 28,000-ton drillship, unattached, unmanned, and carrying 143,000 gallons of diesel fuel, 1,000 gallons of aviation fuel, and 12,000 gallons of petroleum product varietals, ran aground on Sitkalitik Island about 40 minutes later. The resting spot was about 1,400 miles short of Seattle. Thus ended the new learnings on that remote, rocky shoreline, the great operational excellence demonstration that was the 2012 Arctic drilling season came to a close. Shell announced a pause in its Arctic offshore drilling program in Alaska a few months later. The company did take another run at the well in the Chukchi Sea in 2015 and pronounced it a dry hole. Shell would not be back to Arctic Alaska, it announced, for the foreseeable future. Chapter 17. Such a man is born once every few decades. Aspiring to renewed superpower status was a tall order for the Putin government in 2013, and the day-to-day slog of doing what it took to keep the Russian banner flying high was wearing on everybody involved, all the way down the line into the lower ranks. Consider Viktor Pobodny, a 25-year-old agent in Russia's once-vaunted Foreign Intelligence Service, who was finding no great joy in his recent posting. Young Pobodny was assigned to New York at the end of 2012 under the cover of official attaché to the permanent mission of the Russian Federation to the United Nations. Along with his undercover SVR cohort, Igor Sporyshev, whose public face was as a Russian government trade rep working in the U.S., Pobodny had an agenda full to bursting. The pair had to do enough clean work at Russia's government offices in New York to avoid the suspicion of watchful American counterintelligence agents. Sporyshev understood he was likely to draw the attention of the FBI because his father had been a career officer in the Soviet KGB. Meanwhile, the duo was acting as point of contact for one of the few SVR deep cover illegals the U.S. government hadn't swept up in the 2010 dragnet. Sporyshev and Pobodny were also expected to trawl the city's universities and businesses for well-connected Americans who might be recruited as moles and informants. The chances of enticing a sympathetic professor or banker to turn against the United States were lately proving pretty much non-existent. There was a slightly greater chance of getting sufficient dirt, kompromat in SVR parlance, on some American, to blackmail him or her to act as an agent for Russia. The more likely scenario was finding a bored and naive young academic or think tank supernumerary who would unwittingly spill useful information. The useful idiot seemed like the last great hope of Russian spydom in the U.S. in 2013. The gestalt of the whole Russian spying industry in New York was tilting toward demoralized by the time fresh-faced Viktor Pobodny got to town. It didn't take long for him to adopt the attitude, too. In the winter and early spring of 2013, Pobodny and Sporyshev expended hours inside the top-secret secure room of Russia's UN offices on East 67th Street in Manhattan, commiserating about the futility of the agency they dutifully served. Vladimir Putin could drape all the honors available around Anna Chapman and all the other illegals deported from the United States in 2010. But the arrests and public shaming in the West had badly dinged the reputation of the most capable department inside the SVR, Directorate S. No doubt the current batch of U.S.-based SVR agents were all watching the first season of the popular new TV show, The Americans, which had been inspired by the 2010 revelation of the Russian spy ring embedded in the nondescript suburbs of New Jersey and Massachusetts. The creators of the show, however, had set that drama back in time in the 1980s, when the stakes were much higher and the superpower competition more evenly matched. Young Pobodny occasionally defended the current state of Russia's premier espionage program. "First of all, Directorate S is the only intelligence that is real intelligence," he reminded Sporyshev in one of their safe room bull sessions in April 2013. "It was," the older and more experienced agent reminded him, "not so much anymore." Sporyshev knew full well the lone illegal he was running in New York City was good for little more than gathering the sort of business intelligence already available to a casual reader of the Wall Street Journal. "Yeah, I don't know about now," Pobodny relented, with no real fight. "Look, in the States, even the S couldn't do anything. The FBI caught 10 of them. And then Putin even tried to justify that they weren't even tasked to work, that they were sleeper cells in case of martial law. They weren't doing shit here, you understand? I agree that untraditional is more effective, but even the S cannot do anything here." This defeatist attitude invited a certain sloppiness in SVR tradecraft among its New York team. In fact, it's only possible to quote Sporyshev and Pobodny verbatim from that particular April 2013 safe room conversation, along with many others, because those forlorn Russian spies, surprise, were being recorded in that safe room. Every time. Sporyshev and Pobodny had usefully and idiotically and unwittingly carried FBI listening devices into their star chamber, literally into the supposed top-secret secure communications facility inside the Russian UN mission. In fact, everything they did in New York for years was watched and recorded and pored over by the FBI, unbeknownst to those two spies. The G-men who were listening in must have developed some sympathy for these two Russian sad sacks. These guys complained a lot. Sporyshev, for instance, seemed tormented by his inability to recruit any useful American businesswomen. "There was a positive response without feelings of rejection," was about as good a report as he could make. "I have lots of ideas about such girls, but these ideas are not actionable because they don't allow you to get close enough," he explained in the safe room one day. Pobodny took some time in that particular session to whine about his growing irritation with the most promising American contact he had made. Pobodny had struck up a conversation 3 months earlier with a young aspiring New York businessman at a symposium on the worldwide effects of the shale boom. The American, Carter Page, seemed heaven-sent to Pobodny back on January 18, 2013. Here was a 41-year-old graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, who told people he had been a staff-level research fellow on the House Armed Services Committee in the early 90s. He was also an avowed Russophile. He even spoke Russian, or tried to. His recent PhD dissertation focused on governance in the energy industry in oil-rich Central Asia's former Soviet states. New York University's Center for Global Affairs had signed up Carter Page as an adjunct assistant professor. He was teaching a course there, he explained to Pobodny, called Energy in the World. And the almost assistant professor was more than just an academic. His two passions, Page would say, were business development and international relations. He had worked at the Moscow office of Merrill Lynch a decade earlier. He had risen to the position of chief operating officer of its energy and power investment banking group. He remained an avid follower of the Russian energy sector. His chief interest in early 2013 seemed to be the state-owned natural gas monopoly, Gazprom. "I was an advisor for them for many years," Carter Page liked to say. Natural gas was Page's self-described obsession in the months around his impromptu meeting with the young attaché to the Russian mission in New York. And this new acquaintanceship with Pobodny seemed to inspire him. On March 13, 2013, less than 2 months after meeting Pobodny for the first time, Page reserved the name for a new company he was incorporating, Global Natural Gas Ventures, LLC. He registered the company in Oklahoma several weeks later. Its official headquarters of record was, conveniently, just 4 miles down the road from the Chesapeake Energy campus. The idea of the venture, it seemed, was to promote natural gas as the clean fuel alternative of the future, just as Aubrey McClendon had been doing for years. That this idea was a tad stale by 2013 didn't shake Carter Page's resolve. The wheels in Carter Page's head did not turn with a great deal of velocity, but they did exhibit real stamina. When he met again with Pobodny over a Coca-Cola in New York that March, Page's chief interest was in making himself the point of contact between Russian and American natural gas interests. At least that's the way it sounded in Page's explanation to House Intelligence Committee member Mike Quigley during questioning in 2017. "So you two talked about Gazprom?" Quigley asked. "It definitely came up, yes," said Page. "It was me generally talking about some of the things I had been discussing with Chesapeake Energy." This meeting with Pobodny, Page told Quigley, just by the by, also presented an excellent chance to practice his Russian language skills with an actual Russian. "I told him that I had previously worked with Gazprom and that I know that they are similar to Chesapeake Energy in the United States. With the glut of natural gas that there is across Texas, Oklahoma, and around the world, people such as Aubrey McClendon, who I knew at the time was the CEO and founder of Chesapeake Energy, they were looking for new ways to increase natural gas demand. And Russia, coincidentally, at the same time, was also looking to do that and also had made objectives of increasing the use of natural gas in vehicles." Listening to Carter Page talk to the congressman, one could imagine Pobodny's frustration. Carter Page had a tendency to make a lot of words, but rarely herded them toward any discernible meaning. Page did appear to be going out of his way to attract the favor and attention of Russian energy bosses in the spring of 2013. As a fellow at the Center for National Policy, a U.S. national security think tank, Page wrote a blog post extolling the leadership of Igor Sechin in building bridges to Western oil companies such as Exxon. While calling out the Obama administration for imposing excessive restrictions on Russian officials, as seen in last year's Magnitsky Act, which was reminiscent of the blacklists of the McCarthy era, Page also lamented Sechin's uncharitable treatment at the hands of the American press. The frequently unjustified maltreatment of Russia and its leaders in the U.S. media further ingrains long-standing tendencies toward misunderstanding, thereby offering a supersized cover for equally large policy mistakes by the U.S. government. There was no evidence that Page and Pobodny kept up any serious face-to-face contact in the spring of 2013. They had a spotty email exchange, maybe a phone call or two. By his own account, Page mostly offered the Russian his personal outlook on the state of the global energy industry. This amounted to handing over lecture notes and reading materials Page was preparing for his NYU classes. Only at a much lower level, Page would say. And his eyes were kind of glazing over, frankly. "My students in class that year were much more engaged and interested. He showed little to no interest at all." Pobodny was growing just as frustrated with Page by April 2013. The spy was sure that Page's eagerness to make big money in natural gas made him a vulnerable target, a target who might hand over something truly valuable or actionable. But it was also dawning on Pobodny that calling Carter Page a useful idiot was only half accurate. He wasn't proving very useful. He wrote that he is sorry. He went to Moscow and forgot to check his inbox, but he wants to meet when he gets back, Pobodny reported to Sporyshev on April 8, 2013. "I think he is an idiot and forgot who I am." Sporyshev was mainly just listening, letting Pobodny vent. "I like that he takes on everything," the younger spy continued. "I also promised him a lot, that I have connections in the trade representation, meaning you, that you can push contracts. I feed him empty promises." Sporyshev chimed in, "Shit," clearly not happy about the prospect of getting roped into the Carter Page operation. "Then he will write to me." Pobodny told his accomplice not to fret. He wouldn't drag him into this particular abyss. But you kind of had to feel for these two Russian spies. The stupidities of the Carter Page operation were reminders of what felt like the relentless nothingness of their chosen occupation. They might as well be accountants or chemistry teachers. 2 days later, Pobodny and Sporoshev sounded like men headed for an existential crisis. Good grief, look at us. This is what it is to be a spy for one of the greatest countries on Earth. Pobodny complained to Sporoshev on April 10, 2013. I'm sitting with a cookie right now at the chief enemy spot. Fuck, not one point of what I thought then when I signed on, not even close. I thought it would be a little like movies about James Bond. Of course, I wouldn't fly helicopters, but pretend to be someone else at a minimum. Sporoshev was in no mood to buck up his younger protege. I also thought I at least would go abroad with a different passport, he said with a sigh. While Russia's supposedly elite spy agencies were boring their undercover agents half to death, and the FBI was all over their flaccid recruitment efforts in New York, there was another foreign spying effort underway in the United States. And this one was not only wildly successful, it also seemed like a hell of a lot more fun. The new mystery spy came on the scene in the first week of February 2013, sending stolen electronic correspondence and files unsolicited to a handful of outside-the-mainstream media organizations. The hacked files included screenshots of emails exchanged by the family of the former presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Puppets of the Illuminati, the hacker called the Bushes, whatever that meant. There were also screen grabs of the fruits of W's newest hobby. He was trying his hand at painting. The hacker leaked a self-portrait of W himself in the shower, and another of him sitting in his bathtub, alongside its standard run of embarrassing mugshot photos of disheveled, newly arrested celebrities. The website The Smoking Gun wasted no time in uploading the paintings, along with the photographs of George H.W. during his recent hospital stay, and emails that revealed a few relatively innocuous family secrets. The oil paintings accounted for most of the pickup in the wider media. I gazed at the former president's legs and toes in the bathtub, overcome with relief that W. was now under the influence of Lucian Freud rather than Dick Cheney, wrote New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd the next day. The New York Times' art blog weighed in as well with a semi-serious critique. The forms are handled with care, but awkwardly, which is the source of their appeal. Everything is honestly accounted for, not sharply realistic, certainly not finicky. Whatever is going on psychologically, the paintings suggest a man, a painter, at ease with his body. The whole thing seemed like sort of a good time lark, right down to the strange watermark stamped across every item sent. Guccifer. Guccifer's hijinks took a darker turn a month later, when the hacker gained control of former Secretary